This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Killing Lincoln, the shocking assassination that changed America forever. By Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard, this is Bill O'Reilly. The book is dedicated to Makata Wubna, who makes the world a better place. A note to listeners. The story you are about to hear is true and truly shocking. It has been 150 years since the beginning of the Civil War, the bloodiest war in our nation's history, a conflict so full of horror it is almost impossible to describe. The assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, only days after the end of the war, was a terrible tragedy. Much has been speculated about the events leading up to the murder and immediately afterward, but few people know what really happened. Before historian Martin Dugard and I began writing the book, I thought I understood the facts and implications of the assassination. But even though I'm a former history teacher, I had no clue. The ferocious assassination plan itself still has elements that have not been clarified. This is a saga of courage, cowardice, and betrayal. There are layers of proven conspiracy and alleged conspiracy that will disturb you. You will learn much in these pages, and the experience, I believe, will advance your understanding of our country and how Abraham Lincoln's murder changed it forever. This book is a departure from the contemporary nonfiction I've written for more than a decade and from the daily news analysis that I do on TV. But the lessons you will learn within these pages are relevant to all our lives. For those of us who want to improve the United States and keep it the greatest nation in the world, we must be aware of the true heroes who have made the country great, as well as the villains who have besmirched it. Finally, this audiobook will be read as a thriller, but don't let the style fool you. What you are about to hear is unsanitized and uncompromising. It is a no-spin American story, and I am proud of it. Prologue. Saturday, March 4th, 1865, Washington, D.C. The man with 6 weeks to live is anxious. He furrows his brow, as he does countless times each day, and walks out of the Capitol building, which is nearing completion. He is exhausted, almost numb. 50,000 men and women stand in the pouring rain and ankle-deep mud to watch President Lincoln take the oath of office to begin his second term. His new vice president, Andrew Johnson, has just delivered a red-faced, drunken, 20-minute ramble vilifying the South, and that has left the crowd squirming and embarrassed by Johnson's inebriation. So when Abraham Lincoln steps up to the podium and delivers an eloquent appeal for reunification, the spiritual message of his second inaugural address is all the more uplifting. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us, to see the right, let us strive on, to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations, the president intones humbly. Despite his exhaustion, Lincoln is charismatic and momentarily energized. Suddenly the sun bursts through the clouds as he speaks, its light enveloping the tall and outwardly serene Lincoln. But 120 miles away in the Virginia Railroad Junction of Petersburg, any thought of serenity is a fantasy. The Confederate Army, under the command of General Robert E. Lee, has been pinned inside the city for more than 250 days by Union forces under the command of General Ulysses S. Grant. Though living in trenches and reduced to eating rats and raw bacon, Lee's men will not surrender. Instead, Lee is making plans to slip out of Petersburg and escape south to the Carolinas. If he succeeds, Lincoln's prayer for a reunified United States of America may never be answered. America will continue to be divided into a North and a South, a United States of America and a Confederate States of America. Lincoln's inaugural speech is a performance worthy of a great dramatic actor. And indeed, one of America's most famous thespians stands just a few feet away as Lincoln raises his right hand. John Wilkes Booth is galvanized by the president's words, though not in the way Lincoln intends. Booth, 26 years old, raised in Maryland, is an exceptional young man. Blessed with a rakish smile and a debonair gaze, he is handsome, brilliant, witty, charismatic, tender, and able to bed almost any woman he wants, and he has bedded quite a few. It's no wonder that the actor has known success on the Broadway stage. His fiancée stands at his side, a sensual young woman, whose senator father has no idea that his daughter is secretly engaged to a man of Booth's lowly theatrical calling. Lucy Hale and John Wilkes Booth are a beautiful young couple, quite used to the adoration of high society and the opposite sex. Yet not even she knows that Booth is a Confederate sympathizer, one who nurses a pathological hatred for Lincoln and the North. Lucy has no idea that her lover has assembled a crack team of conspirators to help bring down the president. They have guns, financing, and a precise plan. At this point, patience is their watchword. Standing in the cold Washington drizzle in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, Booth feels nothing but hot rage and injustice. The actor is impulsive and prone to the melodramatic. Just before Lincoln's speech, as the president stepped out onto the East Portico, Booth's carefully crafted conspiracy was instantly forgotten. Though he had no gun or knife, Booth lunged at Lincoln. An officer from Washington's Metropolitan Police, a force known to be heavily infiltrated by Confederate sympathizers, grabbed Booth hard by the arm and pulled him back. The actor struggles, which only made Officer John William Westfall grasp him tighter. Like everyone else in the city, Westfall is well aware that there are plots against Lincoln's life. Some say it's not a matter of if, but when the president will die. Yet rather than arrest Booth or even pull him aside for questioning, Westfall accepts Booth's excuse that he merely stumbled. Arresting a celebrity like Booth might have caused the policeman problems. But Booth is definitely not finished. He seethes as he listens to Lincoln's speech. The grace and poetry of the words ignite his rage. The sight of so many black faces beaming up at Lincoln makes him want to vomit. No, Booth is most definitely not finished. If anything, his determination to knock Lincoln off his throne becomes more intense. Lincoln isn't finished either. The president has epic plans for his second term in office. It will take every one of those 4 years and maybe even longer to heal the war-torn nation. Healing is Lincoln's one overriding ambition, and he will use every last bit of his trademark determination to see it realized. Nothing must stand in his way. But evil knows no boundaries, and it is a most powerful evil that is now bearing down on Abraham Lincoln. Part 1. Total War. Chapter 1. Saturday, April 1st, 1865, City Point, Virginia. The man with 14 days to live is himself witnessing death. Lincoln, as he prefers to go by, just his last name, no one calls him Abe, which he loathes. Few call him Mr. President. His wife actually calls him Mr. Lincoln, and his two personal secretaries playfully refer to him as the tycoon. Lincoln paces the upper deck of the steamboat River Queen, his face lit now and again by distant artillery. The night air smells of the early spring, damp with a hint of floral fragrance. The River Queen is docked at City Point, a bustling Virginia port that was infiltrated by Confederate spies last August. Yet Lincoln strides purposefully back and forth, unprotected and unafraid, as vulnerable as a man can be to sniper fire. The bombardment serving as the perfect distraction from his considerable worries. When will this war ever end? As one Confederate soldier put it, the rolling thunder of the heavy metal began at 9 p.m. Once the big guns destroy the Confederate defenses around Petersburg, the Union Army, Lincoln's army, will swarm from their positions and race across no man's land into the enemy trenches, hell-bent on capturing the city that has eluded them for 10 long months. What happens after that is anyone's guess. In a best-case scenario, Lincoln's general-in-chief, Ulysses S. Grant, will trap Confederate General Robert E. Lee and his army inside Petersburg, forcing their surrender. That's a long shot, but if it happens, The four-year-old American Civil War will be over, and the United States will be divided no more. And this is why Abraham Lincoln is watching the battlefield. But Mars Robert, master as rendered in Southern parlance, has proven himself a formidable opponent time and time again. Lee plans to escape and sprint for the North Carolina border to link up with another large rebel force. Lee boasts that his Army of Northern Virginia can hold out forever in the Blue Ridge Mountains, where his men will conceal themselves among the ridges and thickets. There are even bold whispers among the hardcore Confederates about shedding their gray uniforms for plain civilian clothing as they sink undercover to fight guerrilla style. The Civil War will then drag on for years, a nightmare that torments President Lincoln. Lincoln knows that many citizens of the North have lost their stomach for the war, with its modern technology like repeating rifles and long-range artillery that have brought about staggering losses of life. Anti-Lincoln protests have become more common than the battles themselves. Lee's escape could guarantee that the northern states rise up and demand that Lincoln fight no more. The Confederates, by default, will win, making the chances of future reunification virtually non-existent. Nothing scares Lincoln more. He is so eager to see America heal that he has instructed Grant to offer Lee the most lenient surrender terms possible. There will be no punishment of Confederate soldiers, no confiscation of their horses or personal effects, just the promise of a hasty return to their families, farms, and stores, where they can once again work in peace. In his youth on the western frontier, Lincoln was famous for his amazing feats of strength. He once lifted an entire keg of whiskey off the ground, drank from the bung, and then, being a teetotaler, spit the whiskey right back out. An eyewitness swore he saw Lincoln drag a 1,000-pound box of stones all by himself. So astonishing was his physique that another man unabashedly described young Abraham Lincoln as a cross between Venus and Hercules. But now Lincoln's youth has aged into a landscape of fissures and contours. His forehead and sunken cheeks a roadmap of despair and brooding. Lincoln's strength, however, is still there, manifested in his passionate belief that the nation must and can be healed. He alone has the power to get it done, if fate will allow him. Lincoln's top advisors tell him assassination is not the American way, but he knows he's a candidate for martyrdom. His guts churn as he stares out into the night and rehashes and second-guesses his thoughts and actions and plans. Last August, Confederate spies had killed 43 people at City Point by exploding an ammunition barge. Now, at a rail-thin 6'4" with a bearded chin and a nose only a caricaturist could love, Lincoln's unmistakable silhouette makes him an easy target, should spies once again lurk nearby. But Lincoln is not afraid. He is a man of faith. God will guide him one way or another. On this night, Lincoln calms himself with blunt reality. Right now, the most important thing is for Grant to defeat Lee. Surrounded by darkness, alone in the cold, he knows that Grant surrounding Lee and crushing the will of the Confederate Army is all that matters. Lincoln heads to bed long after midnight. Once the shelling stops and the night is quiet enough to allow him some peace, he walks below decks to his stateroom. He lies down. As so often happens when he stretches out his frame in a normal-sized bed, his feet hang over the end, so he sleeps diagonally. Lincoln is normally an insomniac on the eve of battle, but he is so tired from the mental strain of what has passed and what is still to come that he falls into a deep dream state. What he sees is so vivid and painful that when he tells his wife and friends about it 10 days later, the description shocks them beyond words. The dream finally ends as day breaks. Lincoln stretches as he rises from bed, missing his wife back in Washington, but also loving the thrill of being so close to the front. He enters a small bathroom where he stands before a mirror and water basin to shave and wash his hands and face. Lincoln next dons his trademark black suit and scarfs a quick breakfast of hot coffee and a single hard-boiled egg, which he eats while reading a thicket of telegrams from his commanders, including Grant, and from politicians back in Washington. Then Lincoln walks back up to the top deck of the River Queen and stares off into the distance. With a sigh, he recognizes that there is nothing more he can do right now. It is April 2nd, 1865. The man with 13 days left on Earth is pacing. Chapter 2, Sunday, April 2, 1865, Petersburg, Virginia. There is no North versus South in Petersburg right now, only Grant versus Lee, and Grant has the upper hand. Lee is the tall, rugged Virginian with the silver beard and regal air. Grant, 42, is 16 years younger, a small, introspective man who possesses a fondness for cigars and a whisperer's way with horses. For 11 long months, they have tried to outwit one another. But as this Sunday morning descends further and further into chaos, it becomes almost impossible to remember the rationale that has defined their rivalry for so long. At the heart of it all is Petersburg, a 200-year-old city with rail lines spoking outward in five directions. The Confederate capital at Richmond lies 23 miles north, or in military definition, based upon the current location of Lee's army, to the rear. The standoff began last June, when Grant abruptly abandoned the battlefield at Cold Harbor and wheeled toward Petersburg. In what would go down as one of the history's greatest acts of stealth and logistics, Grant withdrew 115,000 men from their breastworks under cover of darkness and marched them south, crossed the James River without a single loss of life, and then pressed due to Petersburg. The city was unprotected. A brisk Union attack would have taken the city within hours. It never happened. Grant's commanders dawdled. Lee raced in reinforcements. The Confederates dug in around Petersburg just in time, building the trenches and fortifications they would call home through the blazing heat of summer, the cool of autumn, and the snow and bitter freezing rain of the long Virginia winter. Under normal circumstances, Grant's next move would be to surround the city, cutting off all those rail lines. He could then effect a proper siege, his encircled troops denying Lee's army and the inhabitants of Petersburg all access to food, ammunition, and other supplies vital to life itself. Or, in more graphic terms, Grant's men would be the hangman's noose choking the life out of Petersburg. Winning the siege would be as simple as cinching the noose tighter and tighter with each passing day, until the rebels died of starvation or surrendered, whichever came first. But the stalemate at Petersburg is not a proper siege, even though the press is fond of calling it that. Grant has Lee pinned down on three sides, but has not surrounded his entire force. The Appomattox River makes that impossible. Broad and deep, it flows through the heart of Petersburg. The Confederates control all land north of the river and use it as a natural barrier against Union attack from the rear. This allows resupply trains to chug down from Richmond on a regular basis, keeping the Confederates armed and fed. In this way, there is normalcy, allowing men like Lee to attend church on Sundays, as he would in peacetime, or a young general like A.P. Hill to live on a nearby estate with his pregnant wife and two small daughters, enjoying parenthood and romance. The men on both sides of the trenches live in squalor and mud, enduring rats and deprivation. But there is order there, too, as they read their newspapers and letters from home and cook their meager breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The Confederate lines are arranged in a jagged horseshoe facing south, 37 miles of trenches and fortifications in all. The outer edges of the horseshoe are 2 miles from the city center, under the commands of A.P. Hill on the Confederate right and John B. Gordon on the left. Both are among Lee's favorite and most courageous generals, so it's natural that he has entrusted Petersburg defenses to them. The cold, hard truth, however, is that Robert E. Lee's dwindling army is reduced to just 50,000 men, only 35,000 of them ready to fight. String them out along 37 miles, and they are spread very thin indeed. But they're tough. Time and again, over the past 293 days, Grant has attacked, and time and again, Lee's men have held fast. Lee cannot win at Petersburg. He knows that. Grant has almost four times as many soldiers and 1,000 more cannon. The steam whistles of approaching trains have grown less and less frequent in the past few months, and Lee's men have begun to starve. Confederate rations were once a pound of meal and a quarter pound of bacon a day, with an occasional tin of peas. Now such a meal would be considered a fantasy. Starvation, literal starvation, was doing its deadly work. So depleted and poisoned was the blood of many of Lee's men from insufficient and unsound food that a slight wound, which would probably not have been reported at the beginning of the war, would often cause blood poison, gangrene, and death, one Confederate general will later write. Many Confederate soldiers slide out of their trenches on moonless nights and sprint over to the Union lines to surrender, anything to fill their aching bellies. Those that remain are at their breaking point. The best Lee can hope for is to escape. For months and months, this has meant one of two options. Abandon the city under cover of darkness and pull back toward Richmond, or punch a hole in the Union lines and march south. In both cases, the goal is to reach the Carolinas and the waiting Confederate reinforcements. On the afternoon of April 1st, Grant removes the second option. At the decisive Battle of Five Forks, General Phil Sheridan and 45,000 men capture a pivotal crossing, cutting off the main road to North Carolina, handing General George Pickett his second disastrous loss of the war, the first coming at Gettysburg, and the infamous ill-fated charge that still bears his name. Five Forks is the most lopsided Union victory of the war. More than 2,900 Southern troops are lost. It is long after dark when word of the great victory reaches Grant. He is sitting before a campfire smoking one of the cigars he came to cherish long ago in the Mexican War. Without pausing, Grant pushes his advantage. He orders another attack along 12 miles of Confederate line. He hopes this will be the crushing blow, the one that will vanquish Lee and his army once and for all. His soldiers will attack just before dawn, but the artillery barrage will commence immediately. This is the bombardment Lincoln watches from 8 miles away in City Point, the president well understanding that the massive barrage will cause devastating casualties and panic in the Confederate ranks. The infantry opens fire at 4 a.m. per Grant's orders, and with a small diversionary attack to the east of Petersburg, cannon and musket fire mainly, just enough to distract the Confederates. 45 minutes later, as soon as there's enough light to see across to the enemy lines, Grant launches hell. Some 100,000 men pour into the Confederate trenches, screaming curses, throwing themselves on the overmatched rebels. The fighting is often hand-to-hand and at such close range that the soldiers can clearly see and smell the men they're killing. And, of course, they hear the screams of the dying. The Union attack is divided into two waves. Just a few hours earlier, Major General John G. Park was so sure that the assault would fail that he requested permission to call it off. But now Park obeys orders and leads the Bluecoats to the right flank. Major General Horatio Wright, employing a revolutionary wedge-shaped attack column, charges from the left flank. Wright is a West Point-trained engineer and will later have a hand in building the Brooklyn Bridge and completing the Washington Monument. He has spent months scrutinizing the Confederate defenses, searching for the perfect location to smash the rebels. Wright is far beyond ready for this day, and so are his men. General Wright's army shatters Lee's right flank, spins around to obliterate A.P. Hill's Third Corps, then makes a U-turn and marches on Petersburg all within 2 hours. The attack is so well choreographed that many of his soldiers are literally miles in front of the main Union force. The first rays of morning sunshine have not even settled upon the Virginia countryside when, lacking leadership and orders, Wright's army is stymied because no other Union divisions have stepped up to assist him. Wright's army must stop its advance. Meanwhile, Lee and his assistants, Generals Pete Longstreet and A.P. Hill, gape at Wright's army from the front porch of Lee's Confederate headquarters. Rather than rush forward, the Union scouts hesitate, looking fearfully at Lee's headquarters. They can see the destruction right in front of them. At first, as Longstreet will later write, it was hardly a light enough to distinguish the blue from the gray. The three of them stand there, Lee with his wrap against the chill, as the sun rises high enough to confirm their worst fears. Every soldier they can see wears blue. A horrified A.P. Hill realizes that his army has been decimated. Lee faces the sobering fact that the Union soldiers are just a few short steps from controlling the main road he plans to use for his personal retreat. Lee will be cut off if the Bluecoats in the pasture continue their advance. The next logical step will be his own surrender. Which is why, as he rushes back into the house and dresses quickly, Lee selects his finest gray uniform, a polished pair of riding boots, and then takes the unusual precaution of buckling a gleaming ceremonial sword around his waist, just in case he must offer it to his captors. It is Sunday, and normally Lee would be riding his great gray gelding, Traveler, into Petersburg for services. Instead, he must accomplish three things immediately. The first is to escape back into the city. The second is to send orders to his generals, telling them to fall back to the city's innermost defenses and hold them until the last man, or nightfall, whichever comes first. The third is to evacuate Petersburg and retreat back across the Petersburg bridges wheel left, and race toward the Carolinas. There, Lee believes he can regain the upper hand. The Confederate Army is a nimble fighting force at its best on open ground, able to feint and parry. Once he regains that open ground, Lee can keep Grant's army off balance and gain the offensive. If any of those three events do not take place, however, he will be forced to surrender, most likely before dusk. Fortune, however, is smiling on General Lee. Those Union soldiers have no idea that Marsh Robert himself is right in front of them, for if they did, they would attack without ceasing. Lee is the most wanted man in America. The soldier who captures him will become a legend. The Union scouts can clearly see the small artillery battery outside Lee's headquarters, the Turnbull House, and assume that it's part of a much larger rebel force hiding out of sight. Too many times on too many battlefields, soldiers who failed to observe such discretion have been shot through like Swiss cheese. Rather than rush forward, the Union scouts hesitate, looking fearfully at Lee's headquarters. Seizing the moment, Lee escapes. By nightfall, sword still buckled firmly around his waist, Lee crosses the Appomattox River and then orders his army to do the same. The final chase has begun. Chapter 3, Monday, April 3rd, 1865, Petersburg, Virginia. Lee's retreat is unruly and time-consuming, despite the sense of urgency. So it is, more than 8 hours after Lee ordered his army to pull out of Petersburg, that General U.S. Grant can still see long lines of Confederate troops marching across the Appomattox River to the relative safety of the opposite bank. The bridges are packed. A cannon barrage could kill hundreds instantly, and Grant's batteries are certainly close enough to do the job. All he has to do is give the command. Yes, it would be a slaughter, but there is still a war to be won. Killing those enemy soldiers makes perfect tactical sense. But Grant hesitates. The war's end is in sight. Killing those husbands and fathers and sons will impede the nation's healing. So now Grant, the man so often labeled a butcher, indulges in a rare act of military compassion and simply lets the Confederates go. He will soon come to regret that decision. For now, his plan is to capture the Confederates, not to kill them. Grant has already taken plenty of prisoners, and even as he watches those rebels escape, he is scheming to find a way to capture even more. The obvious strategy is to give chase, sending the Union army across the Appomattox in hot pursuit. Lee certainly expects that. But Grant has something different in mind. He aims to get ahead of Lee and cut him off. He will allow the Confederates their unmolested 36-hour, 40-mile slog down muddy roads to Amelia Courthouse, where the rebels believe food is waiting. He will let them unpack their rail cars and gulp rations to their heart's content. And he will even allow them to continue their march to the Carolinas, but only for a while. A few short miles after leaving Amelia Courthouse, Lee's army will run headlong into a 100,000-man Union roadblock. This time there will be no river to guard Lee's rear. Grant will slip that noose around the Confederate army, then yank on its neck until it can breathe no more. Grant hands a courier the orders. Then he telegraphs President Lincoln at City Point asking for a meeting. Long columns of rebels still clog the bridges, but the rest of Petersburg is completely empty. Its homes shuttered, the civilians having long ago given them over to the soldiers. And soldiers from both sides are now racing across the countryside toward the inevitable but unknown point on the map where they will fight to the death in a last great battle. Abandoned parapets, tents, and cannons add to the eerie landscape. There was not a soul to be seen, not even an animal in the streets, Grant will later write. There was absolutely no one out there. The 5'8" General Grant, an introspective man whom Lincoln calls the quietest little man he's ever met, has Petersburg completely to himself. He lights a cigar and basks in the still morning air, surrounded by the ruined city that eluded him for 293 miserable days. He is Lee's exact opposite, dark-haired and sloppy in dress. His friends call him Sam. He had, noted a friend from West Point, a total absence of elegance. But like Mars Robert, Grant possesses a savant's aptitude for warfare. Indeed, he is capable of little else. When the Civil War began, he was a washed-up, barely employed West Point graduate who had been forced out of military service, done in by lonely Western outposts and an inability to hold his liquor. It was only through luck and connections that Grant secured a commission in an Illinois regiment. but it was tactical brilliance, courage under fire, and steadfast leadership that saw him rise to the top. The one and only time Grant met Lee was during the Mexican War. Robert E. Lee was already a highly decorated war hero, while Grant was a lieutenant and company quartermaster. He despised being in charge of supplies, but it taught him invaluable lessons about logistics and the way an army could live off the land through foraging when cut off from its supply columns. It was after one such scrounge in the Mexican countryside that the young Grant returned to headquarters in a dirty, unbuttoned uniform. The regal Lee, Virginian gentleman, was appalled when he caught sight of Grant and loudly chastised him for his appearance. It was an embarrassing rebuke, one the thin-skinned, deeply competitive Grant would never forget. Lee isn't the only Confederate general Grant knows from the Mexican War. James Pete Longstreet, now galloping toward Amelia Courthouse, is a close friend who served as Grant's best man at his wedding. At Monterey, Grant rode into battle alongside future Confederate President Jefferson Davis. There are scores of others. And while he'd known many at West Point, it was in Mexico that Grant learned how they fought under fire, their strengths, weaknesses, tendencies. As with the nuggets of information he'd learned as a quartermaster, Grant tucked these observations away and then made keen tactical use of them during the Civil War, just as he is doing right now, sitting alone in Petersburg, thinking of how to defeat Robert E. Lee once and for all. Grant lights another cigar, a habit that will eventually kill him, and continues his wait for Lincoln. He hopes to hear about the battle for Richmond before the president arrives. Capturing Lee's army is of the utmost importance, but both men also believe that a Confederacy without a capital is a doomsday scenario for the rebels. Delivering the news that Richmond has fallen will be a delightful way to kick off their meeting. The sound of horseshoes on cobblestones echoes down the quiet street. It's Lincoln. Once again, the president has courted peril by traveling with just his 11-year-old son, a lone bodyguard, and a handful of government officials. Lincoln knows that historically, assassination is common during the final days of any war. The victors are jubilant, but the vanquished are furious, more than capable of venting their rage on the man they hold responsible for their defeat. A single musket shot during that horseback ride from City Point could have ended Lincoln's life. Despite his profound anxieties about all other aspects of the nation's future, Lincoln chooses to shrug off the risk. At the edge of Petersburg, he trots past the houses of Negroes in the words of one Union colonel, and here and there a squalid family of poor whites, but there's no one else. No one, at least, with enough guts to shoot the president. And while the former slaves grin broadly, the whites gaze down with an air of lazy dislike, disgusted that this tall, bearded man is once again their president. Stepping down off his horse, Lincoln walks through the main gate of the house Grant has chosen for the meeting. He takes the walkway in long, eager strides, a smile suddenly stretching across his face, his deep fatigue vanishing at the sight of his favorite general. When he shakes Grant's hand in congratulation, it is with great gusto, and Lincoln holds on to Grant for a very long time. The president appears to be so happy that Grant's aides doubt he's ever had a more carefree moment in his life. The air is chilly. The two men sit on the veranda, taking no notice of the cold. They have become a team during the war, or as Lincoln puts it, Grant is my man and I am his. One is tall, the other quite small. One is a storyteller, the other a listener. One is a politician, the other thinks that politics is a sordid form of show business. But both are men of action, and their conversation shows deep mutual respect. Former slaves begin to fill the yard, drawn back into Petersburg by the news that Lincoln himself is somewhere in the city. They stand quietly in front of the house, watching as the general and the president proceed with their private talk. Lincoln is a hero to the slaves, Father Abraham, guiding them to the promised land with the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln and Grant talk for 90 minutes, then shake hands goodbye. Their parting has a bittersweet feel, the two great men perhaps sensing that they are marching toward two vastly different destinies. Grant is off to finish an epic war and subsequently to become president himself. Lincoln is off to heal a nation, a noble goal he will not live to see realized. Now, as the president looks on, Grant saddles up his charger and gallops off to join his army. Before leaving himself, Lincoln shakes hands with some people in the crowd gathering in front of the meeting place. He then rides back to City Point, once again exposing himself to possible violence. The way is littered with hundreds of dead soldiers, their unburied bodies swollen by death and sometimes stripped bare by scavengers. Lincoln doesn't look away, absorbing the sober knowledge that these men died because of him. Outrage about Lincoln's pursuit of the war has many calling for his death, even in the North. Let us also remind Lincoln that Caesar had his Brutus, one speaker cried at a New York City rally. And even in Congress, one senator recently asked a simple question. How much more are we going to take before going on to allude the possibility of Lincoln's murder? Lincoln endures all this because he must, just as he endures a slow trot through the battlefield. But there is a purpose to all he does, and upon his return to City Point, he receives a great reward when he's handed the telegram informing him that Richmond has fallen. Confederate troops have abandoned the city to link up with Lee's forces trying to get to the Carolinas. Thank God that I have lived to see this, Lincoln cries. It seems to me I have been dreaming a horrid dream for 4 years, and now the nightmare is gone. But it's not really gone. President Lincoln has just 12 days to live. Chapter 4, Tuesday, April 4th, 1865, Newport, Rhode Island. As blood flows in Virginia, wine flows in Rhode Island, far removed from the horrors of the Civil War. It is here that John Wilkes Booth has traveled by train for a romantic getaway with his fiancée. Since the Revolutionary War, Newport has been a retreat for high society, known for yachting and mansions and gaiety. John Wilkes Booth is one of 8 children born to his flamboyant actor father, Junius Brutus Booth, a rogue if there ever was one. Booth's father abandoned his first wife and 2 children in England and fled to America with an 18-year-old London girl who became Booth's mother. Booth was often lost in the confusion of the chaotic household. His father and brother eclipsed him as actors, and his upbringing was hectic, to say the least. Now anger has become a way of life for him. Throughout his journey to Rhode Island, he has been barraged by news of the Southern demise. Northern newspapers are reporting that Richmond has fallen, and that Confederate President Jefferson Davis and his entire cabinet fled the city just hours before Union troops entered. In cities like New York, Boston, and Washington, people are dancing in the streets as the rebel collapse appears to be imminent. It is becoming clear to Booth that he is a man with a destiny, the only man in America who can end the Norse oppression. Something drastic must be done to preserve slavery, the Southern way of life, and the Confederacy itself. If Robert E. Lee can't get the job done, then Booth will have to do it for him. Booth's hatred for Abraham Lincoln and his deep belief in the institution of slavery coalesced into a silent rage after the Emancipation Proclamation. It was only in August 1864, when a bacterial infection sidelined him from the stage, that Booth began using his downtime to recruit a gang that would help him kidnap Lincoln. First, he contacted his old friends Michael O'Loughlin and Samuel Arnold. They met at Barnum City Hotel in Baltimore, and after several drinks, Booth asked them if they would join his conspiracy. Both men agreed. From there, Booth began adding others, selecting them based on expertise with weapons, physical fitness, and knowledge of Southern Maryland's back roads and waterways. In October, Booth traveled to Montreal, where he met with agents of Jefferson Davis. The Confederate president had set aside more than $1 million in gold to pay for acts of espionage and intrigue against the Union, and housed a portion of the money in Canada. Booth's meeting with Davis's men not only provided funding for his conspiracy, it forged a direct bond between himself and the Confederacy. He returned with a check for $1,500, along with a letter of introduction that would allow Booth to meet more prominent Southern sympathizers in Maryland, such as Samuel Mudd and John Surratt, who would become key players in his evil plan. Without their help, Booth's chances of successfully smuggling Lincoln out of Washington and into the Deep South would have been non-existent. After recovering from his illness, Booth immersed himself deeper into the Confederate movement, traveling with a new circle of friends that considered the kidnapping of Lincoln to be of vital national importance. He met with secret agents and sympathizers in taverns, churches, and hotels throughout the Northeast and down through Maryland, always expanding his web of contacts, making his plans more concise and his chances of success that much greater. What started as an almost abstract hatred of Lincoln had now transformed itself into the actor's life's work. Yet Booth is such a skilled actor and charismatic liar that no one outside the secessionist movement not even his fiancée, knew the depth of his rage. Until today. Booth's betrothed, Lucy Lambert Hale, is the daughter of John Parker Hale, a staunchly pro-war senator from New Hampshire. She is dark-haired and full-figured, with blue eyes that have ignited a spark in the heart of many a man. Like Booth, she is used to having her way with the opposite sex, attracting beaux with a methodical mix of flattery and teasing. But Lucy is no soft touch. She can quickly turn indifferent and even cruel toward her suitors if the mood strikes her. Among those enraptured with Miss Hale is the future Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., now a 24-year-old Union officer. Also John Hay, one of Lincoln's personal secretaries. And finally, none other than Robert Todd Lincoln, the president's 21-year-old son, also a Union officer. Despite her engagement to Booth, Lucy still keeps in touch with both Hay and young Lincoln, among many other men. Strikingly pretty, Lucy appeals to Booth's vanity. When they're together, heads turn. The couple's initial passion was enough to overcome societal obstacles, at least in their minds. But by March 1865, their engagement isn't much of a secret anymore, and they are even seen together at the second inaugural. But in the past month, with Lucy possibly accompanying her father to Spain, and Booth secretly plotting against the president, their relationship has become strained. They've begun to quarrel. It doesn't help that Booth flies into a jealous rage whenever Lucy so much as looks at another man. One night in particular, he went mad at the sight of her dancing with Robert Lincoln. Whether or not this has anything to do with his pathological hatred for the president will never be determined. Booth has told Lucy nothing about the conspiracy or his part in it. She doesn't know that his hiatus from the stage was extended by his maniacal commitment to kidnapping Lincoln. She doesn't know about the secret trips to Montreal and New York to meet with other conspirators, nor about the hidden caches of guns or the buggy that Booth purchased specifically to ferry the kidnapped president out of Washington. Nor does she know about the money transfers that fund his entire operation. Lucy doesn't even know that his head is filled with countless crazy scenarios concerning the Lincoln kidnapping. And she surely doesn't realize that her beloved has a passion for New York City prostitutes and a sizzling young Boston teenager named Isabel Sumner, just 17 years old. Lucy knows none of that. All she knows is that the man she loves is mysterious and passionate and fearless in the bedroom. Perhaps with all of Booth's subterfuge, it is not surprising that their lover's getaway to Newport is turning into a fiasco. Booth checked them into the Aquidneck House Hotel, simply signing the register as J.W. Booth and Lady. He made no attempt whatsoever to pretend they're already married. It's as if the couple is daring the innkeeper to question their propriety. There's no question that Booth is spoiling for a fight. He's sick of what he sees as the gross imbalance between the poverty of the war-torn South and the prosperity of the North. Other than the uniformed soldiers milling about the railway platforms, he saw no evidence during the train ride from Washington to Newport via Boston that the war had even touched the North in any way. After checking into the hotel, he and Lucy walked the waterfront all morning. He wants to tell her about his plans, but the conspiracy is so vast and so deep that he would be a fool to sabotage it with a careless outburst. Instead, he rambles on about the fate of the Confederacy and about Lincoln, the despot. He shared his pro-Southern leanings with Lucy in the past, but never to this extent. He rants endlessly about the fall of Richmond and the injustice of Lincoln having his way. Lucy knows her politics well, and she argues right back, until at some point in their walk along the picturesque harbor with its sailboats and magnificent seaside homes, it becomes clear that they will never reach a common ground. Toward evening, they stop their fighting and walk back into the Aquidneck House. Despite John Wilkes Booth's many infidelities, Lucy Hale is the love of his life. She is the only anchor that might keep him from committing a heinous crime, effectively throwing his life away in the process. In her eyes, he sees a happy future replete with marriage, children, and increased prosperity as he refocuses on his career. They can travel the world together, mingling with high society wherever they go, thanks to her father's considerable connections. All he has to do is to choose that love over his insane desire to harm the president. Booth tells the desk clerk that Lucy isn't feeling well and that they will take their evening meal in the bedroom. Upstairs, there is ample time for lovemaking before their food is delivered. But the acts of intimacy that made this trip such an exotic idea in the first place have been undone by the news about Richmond. They will never make love again after tonight, and both of them sense it. Rather than spend the night together, Booth and Lucy pack their bags and catch the evening train back to Boston, where she leaves him to be with friends. Booth is actually relieved. He has made his choice. Now no one stands in his way. Chapter 5, Tuesday, April 4th, 1865, Amelia Courthouse, Virginia. As Booth and Lucy depart Newport long before their supper can be delivered, Robert E. Lee's soldiers are marching 40 miles to dine on anything they can find, all the while looking over their shoulders, fearful that Grant and the Union Army will catch them from behind. Lee has an 8-hour head start after leaving Petersburg. He figures that if he can make it to Amelia Courthouse before Grant catches him, he and his men will be amply fed by the waiting 350,000 rations of smoked meat, bacon, biscuits, coffee, sugar, flour, and tea that are stockpiled there. Then, after that brief stop to fill their bellies, they will resume their march to North Carolina. And march they must, even though Jefferson Davis and his cabinet have already fled Richmond and traveled to the Carolinas on the very same rail line that is delivering the food to Lee's forces. There is no chance of the Army using that railway as an escape route. There simply isn't enough time to load and transport all of Lee's 30,000 men. The day-and-a-half trudge to Amelia Courthouse begins optimistically enough, with Lee's men happy to be finally away from Petersburg and looking forward to their first real meal in months. But 40 miles on foot is a long way, and mile by mile the march turns into a death pageant. The line of retreating rebels and supply wagons stretches for 20 miles. The men are in wretched physical condition after months in the trenches. Their feet have lost their calluses and their muscles the firm tone they knew earlier in the war, when the Army of Northern Virginia was constantly on the march. Even worse, each painful step is a reminder that of the two things vital to an army on the move, food and sleep, they lack one and have no chance of getting the other. Lee's army is in total disarray. There is no longer military discipline or any attempt to enforce it. The men swear under their breaths, grumbling and swearing 1,000 other oaths about wanting to go home and quit this crazy war. The loose columns of Confederate soldiers resemble a mob of hollow-eyed zombies instead of a highly skilled fighting force. The men rumble like persons in a dream, one captain will later write. It all seemed to me like a troubled vision. I was consumed by fever, and when I attempted to walk, I staggered like a drunken man. The unlucky are barefoot. Their leather boots and laces rotted away from the rains and mud of winter. Others wear ankle-high Confederate brogans with holes in the soles and uppers. The only men sporting new boots are those who stripped them off dead Union soldiers. The Southerners resent that everything the Union soldiers wear seems to be newer, better, and in limitless supply. A standing order has been issued for Confederate soldiers not to dress in confiscated woolen Union overcoats, but, given a choice between being accidentally shot by a fellow Southerner or surviving the bitter nightly chill, the rebels pick warmth every time. A glance up and down the retreat shows the long gray line speckled everywhere with blue. Bellies rumble. No one sings. No one bawls orders. A Confederate officer later sets the scene. There is no regular column or regular pace. When a soldier became weary, he fell out, ate his scanty rations, if indeed he had any at all to eat, rested, rose, and resumed the march, when the inclination dictated. There were not many words spoken. An indescribable sadness weighed upon us. It is even harder for the troops evacuating Richmond on their way to link up with Lee at Amelia Courthouse. Many are not soldiers at all. They are sailors who burn their ships rather than let them fall into Union hands. Marching is new to them. Mere hours into the journey, many have fallen out of the ranks from blisters and exhaustion. Making matters worse is the very real fear of Union troops launching a surprise attack. The nervousness, a Confederate major will remember, resulting from this constant strain of starvation, fatigue, and lack of sleep, was a dangerous thing, sometimes producing lamentable results. On several occasions, bewildered Confederate troops open fire on one another, thinking they're firing at Yankees. In another instance, a massive black stallion lashed to a wooden fence reared back, pulling the rail out of the fence and dragging it after him full gallop down the road, crowded with troops, mowing them down like the scythe of a war chariot. It's no wonder that men began to desert. Whenever and wherever the column pauses, men slip into the woods, never to return. The war is clearly over. No sense dying for nothing. Lee has long craved the freedom of open ground, but now his objective is to retreat and regroup, not to fight. His strategy that his army must endeavor to harass them, if we cannot destroy them, depends upon motivated troops and favorable terrain. These are essential to any chance of Lee snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. But the fight will have to wait until they get food. To lighten his army's load and move faster, Lee orders that all unnecessary guns and wagons be left behind. The pack animals pulling them are hitched to more essential loads. A few days from now, as bone-thin and weary as the soldiers themselves, these animals will be butchered to feed Lee's men. Everything about the retreat, starvation, poor morale, desertion, speaks of failure. And yet, when messengers arrive saying that the Petersburg bridges were blown by his sappers once the last man was across, making it impossible for Grant to follow, Lee is optimistic, even happy. He has escaped once again. I have got my army safely out of its breastworks, and in order to follow me, the enemy must abandon his lines and can derive no further benefits from his railroads or James River, Lee notes with relief. Grant's army is sliding west en masse, racing to block the road even as Lee feels relief in the morning air. Lee suspects this, but his confidence in his army and in his own generalship is such that he firmly believes he can defeat Grant on open ground. Everything depends on getting to Amelia Courthouse. Without food, Lee's men cannot march. Without food, they cannot fight. Without food, they might as well have surrendered in Petersburg. Lee's newfound optimism slowly filters down into the ranks. Against all odds, his men regain their confidence as the trenches of Petersburg recede further and further into memory and distance. By the time they reach Amelia Courthouse on April 4th, after almost two consecutive days on the march, electricity sizzles through the ranks. The men speak of hope and are confident of victory as they wonder where and when they will fight the Yankees once again. It's just before noon. The long hours in the saddle are hard on the 58-year-old general. Lee has long struggled with rheumatism and all its crippling agonies. Now it flares anew, yet he presses on, knowing that any side of personal weakness will be immediately noticed by his men. As much as any soldier, Lee looks forward to a good meal and a few hours of sleep. He can see the waiting railroad cars neatly parked on a siding. He quietly gives the order to unload the food and distribute it in an organized fashion. The last thing Lee wants is for his army to give in to their hunger and rush the train. Composure and propriety are crucial for any effective fighting force. The train doors are yanked open. Inside, great wooden crates are stacked floor to ceiling. Lee's excited men hurriedly jerk the boxes down onto the ground and pry them open. Then, horror. This is what those boxes contain. 200 crates of ammunition, 164 cartons of artillery harnesses, and 96 carts to carry ammunition. There is no food. Chapter 6, Tuesday, April 4th, 1865, Richmond, Virginia. While John Wilkes Booth is still in Newport, a hungry Robert E. Lee is in Amelia Courthouse, Ulysses S. Grant is racing to block Lee's path, and Abraham Lincoln stands on the deck of the USS Malvern as the warship chugs slowly and cautiously up the James River toward Richmond. The channel is choked with burning warships and the floating corpses of dead draft horses. Deadly anti-ship mines known as torpedoes bob on the surface, drifting with the current ready to explode the instant they come into contact with a vessel. If just one torpedo bounces up against the Malvern's hull, ship and precious cargo alike will be reduced to fragments of varnished wood and human tissue. Again, Lincoln sets aside his concerns, for the Malvern is sailing into Richmond, of all places. The Confederate capital is now in Union hands. The president has waited an eternity for this moment. Lincoln can clearly see that Richmond, or what's left of it, hardly resembles a genteel southern bastion. The sunken ships and torpedoes in the harbor tell only part of the story. Richmond is gone, burned to the ground, and it was not a Union artillery bombardment that did the job, but the people of Richmond themselves. When it becomes too dangerous for the Malvern to go any farther, Lincoln is rowed to shore. We pass so close to the torpedoes that we could have put our hands on them and touched them, bodyguard William Crook will later write. His affection for Lincoln is enormous. And of all the bodyguards, Crook fusses most over the president, treating him like a child who must be protected. It is Crook who is fearful, while Lincoln bursts with amazement and joy that this day has finally come. And finally, he steps from the barge up until the landing. But what Lincoln sees now can only be described as appalling. Richmond's Confederate leaders have had months to prepare for the city's eventual surrender. They had plenty of time to come up with a logical plan for a handover of power without loss of life. But such was their faith in Morris Robert that the people of Richmond thought that day would never come. When it did, they behaved like fools. Their first reaction was to destroy the one thing that could make the Yankees lose control and vent their rage on the populace, whiskey. Union troops had gone on a drunken rampage after taking Columbia, South Carolina 2 months earlier, and then burned the city to the ground. Out came the Axis. Teams of men roamed through the city, hacking open barrel after barrel of fine sour mash. Thousands of gallons of spirits were poured into the gutters. But the citizens of Richmond were not about to see all that whiskey go to waste. Some got down on their hands and knees and lapped it up from the gutter. Others filled their hats and boots. The street lamps were black because Richmond's gas lines had been shut off to prevent explosions. Perfectly respectable men and women, in a moment of amazing distress, found a salve for their wounds by falling to their knees and quenching their thirst with alcohol flowing in the gutter. Many took more than just a drink. Everyone, from escaped prisoners to indigent laborers and war deserters, drank their share. Great drunken mobs soon roamed the city. Just as in Amelia Courthouse, food was first and foremost on everyone's minds. The city had suffered such scarcity that starvation balls had replaced the standard debutante and charity galas. But black market profiteers had filled entire warehouses with staples like flour, coffee, sugar, and delicious smoked meats. And, of course, there were Robert E. Lee's 350,000 missing rations, neatly stacked in a Richmond railway siding, instead of being packed on the train that Lee expected in Amelia Courthouse. Little did the general know that Confederate looters had stolen all the food. Yet the worst was still to come. Having destroyed and consumed a potential supply of alcohol for the Union Army, Richmond City Fathers now turned their attention to their most profitable commodity, tobacco. The rebel leadership knew that President Lincoln wanted to capture tobacco stores in order to sell them to England, thereby raising much-needed money, the nearly bankrupt U.S. Treasury. In their panic, the city fathers ignored an obvious problem. Lighting tinder-dry bales of tobacco on fire would also burn the great old wooden warehouses in which they were stacked. Soon, spires of flame illuminated the entire city of Richmond. The warehouse flames spread to other buildings. The rivers of whiskey caught fire, and inferno ensued. The true nature of a firestorm involves not only flame, but also wind and heat and crackling and popping and explosion, just like war. Soon residents mistakenly believed the Yankees were laying Richmond to waste with an artillery barrage. And still, things got worse. The Confederate Navy chose this moment to set the entire James River arsenal ablaze, preferring to destroy their ships and ammunition rather than see them fall into Union hands. But the effect of this impulsive tactical decision was far worse than anything the Northerners would have inflicted.